Hello, everybody. I'm Pete Sanchez, reporter for the Catholic Star Herald newspaper, and with Mike Walsh, we are Talking Catholic. You are listening to Catholic Community of South Jersey's stories, and please let us know how we're doing. This is for you, and we would want to know the good news in South Jersey. So please give us, Mike. How are you? Before I go any further,
I'm fine. I think you broke a sentence there.
I think, well, but, you know, it was because I was thinking all along we are on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those places.
We've made it we've gone as broad as possible on between social media and all of the different distribution tools that podcasts allow. I think we've maxed out. And then we show up on other aggregator sites as well, but SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher are the four that we're actively on right now.
That we are. And I think I have to, somebody had the good fortune to tell me we should not be asking for 4 stars on iTunes. We should be asking for 5.
That's an excellent point. Well, you know what? No. We're modest. It's okay. We're very modest. We don't need 5 stars. We're cool with 4. But 5 stars would be nice, too.
Give us 4, and if you're generous, give us 5, please.
So, by the way, I'm 99% sure that the person who told you that is the guy that sits next to you at work.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Thank you, Tom, for correcting us. You're our best critic.
Yeah, I know. He is our fact checker. He really is.
We're gonna turn him into the complaint department. It'll be perfectly fine. Please send all your complaints to Tom O'Shea at the Catholic Star Herald. Tom, I just name dropped you. You're famous.
Great. I'm going to hear it from him the next day, probably. But so once again, we're Talking Catholic, and we're long form. We do this every week. Let us know how we're doing, and we want to hear the stories of South Jersey. What is going on in the Catholic Church? Please let us know, and anybody else out there, including Tom, give us feedback. So we got a couple of interesting things going on, Mike, coming up. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm really excited about this Saturday, May 20th, in Camden at the Cathedral, we really have a joyous event. Deacon Adam Chachowski, I keep thinking I'm butchering that name. I'm sorry, Deacon Adam, almost priest, Father Adam, will be ordained to the priesthood by Bishop Sullivan on this Saturday, May 20th, 10:30, at the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception. So come out. It's really another priest for our diocese, another shepherd for our church, which is what we sorely need right now. So please pray for him and pray for the diocese. And
you know, just to hop on that, we were recently at the iRacer Vocations at Williamstown High School, which had a great turnout this year, as always. About 1,000 people came out. Yeah. It was a wonderful event, beautiful event. Really, people, you know, really, you know, connecting with the need for vocations, not just in our diocese, but, you know, throughout the world. And one of the things the bishop brought up at the end of Mass was really encouraging people to come out and view the ordination if they've never seen one before. It's a beautiful ceremony. I've been to maybe 4 or 5 over my life, certainly. Since I joined the diocese in the last 2 years, I've gone to them far more frequently. Yeah. But it really is, it's a beautiful moment in a priest's life to become ordained. And it's a really beautiful moment in the diocesan life to see this new shepherd coming into the fold, particularly if it's one you've gotten to know over the past 6 to 8 years as he's gone through the vocations process.
Yeah, I've known Deacon Adam for a number of years, and he really is such a great guy, and he'll be a great priest. Speaking of the iRace, unfortunately, Mike, you know, I couldn't make it. I've made all of them but this one. But because of another event in the church, one of my very good friends, his son was baptized at a local church in the diocese. So that was really nice to see that ceremony. And it wasn't just him. It was a lot of other different babies with their families being with the chrism and the oil and the water. That it was just, it's nice, you know, and also renewing our baptismal vows, mm-hmm. parents, the godparents, and even the congregation. So that was beautiful. It was kind of a reminder for me about what I'm doing here and what I'm called to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Anytime you can make it to one of those special occasions, I think it sort of if any of your spirituality might lag over the course of the year, it's moments like that to kind of bring it back again.
Yeah.
And there's something else coming up.
There's the day after the ordination, May 21st, is the New Jersey Catholic Youth Rally out in Jackson, New Jersey. Six Flags Great Adventure and the Diocese of Camden will be there. I believe it's $50, and you get to get the rides, all-you-can-eat buffet. There will be Mass in the afternoon. Registration starts in the morning. For complete info, go to www.canondiocese.org/youth-and-young-adult. And you can talk to Greg Coogan, and you can email him, gregory.coogan@canondiocese.org. He's the director of youth and young adult ministries.
And so, were you planning on going to that?
I probably will be there. I do not know how many roller coasters I will be on. I don't know about the loop-de-loops.
I was talking to my wife. I was waiting with my son today at the bus stop, and my wife comes outside and goes, "Hey, Jack, do you want to go to, you know, this thing going on at the Six Flags?" And I go, "Hey, wait a second. That's something I've worked with." I said, "Oh, so I might be there."
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
Could you do me a favor, though? I'm afraid of rides, so can you ride them with my wife because she loves them?
Sure. Okay. No problem. Yeah. I haven't been to Great Adventure in a while.
Yeah,
so
me neither.
I think they have Nitro and King to come, maybe.
I'm just going to find the churro stand and just sit there and eat.
That sounds delicious, especially with one of the guests that we have here. I think churros being Spanish food will be.
Okay.
Very, yeah.
Okay, you chose an unusual transition. I was going to go slightly differently. Here's the transition I was going to go with. So
the churro transition is best.
Not the churro transition. I was going to go with the fact that, so our guests today are near and dear to my heart because I come from a law background. And one of the areas, I think, of Catholic faith that most people tend not to really understand is canon law. And so we have two canon lawyers with us today. We'll be talking about the tribunal, which exists within the Diocese of Camden, exists within every diocese, canon law in general, and sort of what brought them here today. So may I introduce our two guests today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Father David Klein. I'm the judicial vicar for the Diocese of Camden.
And my name is Christina Hernandez. I'm an ecclesiastical judge for the Diocese of Camden.
And these are two people that work in our building all the time, and we never get to see them very often because they are usually buried under quite a bit of paperwork. However, they are two of the nicest people we know and have great, great backstories.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So how's everything going today? Is the tribunal moving along? Things are being processed?
Things are being processed, yes. That's a good way to put it.
Okay. So I guess I really want to start with the number one question I have is, so what is canon law? Give me a definition of canon law and why we have it in the church.
Well, the law is there to provide the church community with guidelines as to how to function. I mean, like every society has its rules and regulations to help keep order, and the church is no different. So canon law provides a sense of order and structure within the church to help keep it functioning, so it's able to do the mission entrusted to it by Jesus.
Yeah. And when did canon law really take effect? Like how many hundreds of years ago did...
We have the oldest operating legal system in the world.
Really?
It dates back to Roman law, or we have our roots in Roman law. So mm-hmm. It's the longest continually existing legal system.
Wow. So that's why it's a big book, basically.
Yeah.
It goes back quite a while.
We have right now, the current code that we're using dates back from 1983. It was John Paul II.
That's right.
I think I had to delve into that for some story. Right. And yeah, it was intense.
But it doesn't mean that it was invented in 1983. 1983 was right. The latest revision
right.
of the law.
Right.
But it dates back to Roman law.
Basically. But it's something that's touched on all the time. I mean, if certainly when the parish mergers were happening, there's a lot of canon law that goes into the parish mergers. The annulments, which both of you work on, there's a lot of canon law that goes into annulments. Pretty much any decree that's announced, there's some canon law that's put into that. As a matter of fact, I was, we were doing the decree for the the St. Patrick's Day decree.
About eating meat.
Yeah, about right. the yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. lifting the.
There's also canon law for public communications for
yes.
radio broadcast.
Yes. And even as Pete was saying earlier, you know, about being a godfather, you know, the recent baptism, that all you know how we celebrate the sacraments is also part of, you know, the canon law. So it's not just the big book you've seen us lug around, you know, here in the office. It's also, you know, spread out in areas, you know, kind of permeates our life as Catholic Christians and how we celebrate and how we live our lives, you know, as Catholic Christians.
So what brought you to canon lawyering?
Long story short, in Holy Week of 1999, I received a call from, at the time, the Bishop's Secretary for Bishop McHugh, who was now Bishop James Cecchio, asking if I would consider going back to school. When I asked him for what, he said, well, you know, canon law. And I said, well, you know, I've been a chaplain. He was a hospital chaplain at the time. And his response was, well, okay, but do you still want to go back to school? And I said, well, you know, my parents didn't raise a complete idiot. If someone's willing to send me back to school, I'll go back to school.
Right.
And it was then that I started in the summer session at Catholic University for the canon law degree, the JCL degree. Mm-hmm. But that's how that happened. I received a phone call and the bishop asked me to, you know, return to school for studies, and I agreed.
I will say that every time I've asked this question to a canon lawyer who happens to be a priest, it's always, so I got a call. Right. Not usually something they were planning on doing. It's something that they, not quite shanghaied into doing, but encouraged to do.
Well, I mean, the choice was always mine. I mean, and at the time, Monsignor Cecchio, you know, made that clear. But members of the Continuing Education and Spiritual Formation Committee, you know, had seen the work I had done and the effort that I put into getting myself certified as a chaplain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their contention, quite frankly, was he's a hard worker and we'll get our money from him. I mean, they
it's a good reputation
to
have.
So, I mean, That was a bit of encouragement, I guess. You know, they had that kind of confidence in me. But I mean, the choice was always mine. Mm-hmm. And once I, you know, started into the summer sessions, you know, and learning more than what we had learned, you know, during seminary training, it just became something that I was really interested in continuing. Mm-hmm. So I really don't feel like I was, you know, strong-armed into doing it. And it's been, you know, it's been a good walk.
Excellent. Now, Dr. Flores, yourself,
it was kind of a circuitous route to canon law. I have a first career in international finance, so I was doing that. I was working at the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and I had this idea that I wanted to go do missionary life, so I went to do a year of mission in Cuba. And when I came back, I decided that I wanted to change careers. So doing canon law was the closest thing to government international finance. It was kind of the more analytic aspect of church degrees. So I decided that it was the best fit for me, so I went. And I loved it. Ever since the first day, I loved canon law.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. You're one of the special people.
I know. They love this kind of stuff. Everybody else in my class was there under obedience. I was there because I wanted to be there.
Well, that's a good person to have in your back pocket, the one who wants to be there. Now, and you have kind of an interesting background in the sense that you you are not of here. You're not a South Jersey native.
I'm actually from Central New Jersey. I know here they consider it North Jersey, but I'm from Piscataway.
I mean, it's not.
We've everything over Burlington County is North Jersey to us.
And the funny thing is, to us, South Jersey is like a whole other little culture. Yeah. It's another world that you don't know about unless you come to work here.
If you have to be here, right?
It's got its own culture.
And you spend your time not in this diocese sometimes, but in another country.
I go back and forth to Cuba about 3 times a year. Mm-hmm. I volunteer there for their tribunal, actually. Mm-hmm. Where in Cuba, I'm only one of 2 cattle lawyers in the whole country. So we handle everything.
Wow. And you go to D.C. as well, right?
And I also go back and forth to D.C.
Wow. Yeah. So
I spend a lot of hours on the highway every week.
Yeah, I hope you have good music. or good podcasts.
Good podcasts.
You
know? Yeah. This is definitely Stitcher.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks for the shout out on Stitcher. The see Stitcher, you know, we promote you guys. And both of you have been written up on several times in the Catholic Star Herald for the work you do. Christina, most recently, you also helped organize the papal trip to Cuba a few years ago.
Couple of visits, actually.
Really, both of them. I didn't realize. Oh, wow. That's good. So you're sort of touched into everything. That's the thing with these canon lawyers. They're always involved in, they got their hands in everything. That's fun.
I wouldn't say everything, but we get involved in a lot of things.
Now, let's talk about the tribunal a little bit. What is the tribunal?
The tribunal essentially is the bishop's, let me back up a little bit. The bishop is the head of the diocese in terms of like our country, you know, executive, judicial, administrative. But because he can't do everything himself, you know, like our court system, you know, civilly, the church also has its court system, which is centered in the tribunal as opposed to, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States. We have the tribunal that is, in essence, the judicial branch of the bishop. I'm a judicial vicar because my position is a vicarious position of the bishop himself, if that makes sense. I operate in his stead in terms of running the tribunal. I'm sorry, I'm okay, now we got it.
Just fading away from the blank a little
so,
bit.
So, me and my staff operate, you know, keep that function of the bishop's powers running, operating, because he can't do it himself.
Okay.
Christine, I don't know if you'd like to
add to that. Yeah, so the tribunal is basically the court for the diocese, and we give the faithful access to legal services when there is any type of dispute. Most of the disputes that we handle revolve around sacraments, especially marriage. Mm. But there's the possibility that there could be other types of disputes or legal needs that people have in terms of their sacraments. And also we could handle cases if they came up about monetary disputes, penal issues, any type of crime in the church, we can handle those also. So it's a service that people need when there is a dispute or some type of a discrepancy about how things are going to be done. Mm-hmm. And then we're able to give people access to legal services.
So much like any other legal service that people are familiar with in the secular world.
Exactly.
People have rights and obligations in the church just as much as they have rights and obligations in civil society. So we would be the people who would help them understand what those rights and obligations are, you know, in terms of they're having difficulties, in a particular parish setting or even a, you know, work setting, you know, here, you know, in the diocesan offices. Mm-hmm. And essentially we just assist people in determining what their status in the church is, mm-hmm. According to the rights and obligations as outlined in, you know, canon law. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's perfect.
Pete, did that make sense to you?
It did.
Okay,
it,
good.
And I think I've worked with both of you on Father Klein, mostly with you, and I know Mike has too. I did a story years ago, and then Mike brought it. You know, one of the issues that's come up is annulments in the church. What is an annulment?
Yeah, we do about 99% of our work is annulments right now. Mm-hmm. So an annulment is not a Catholic divorce. This is what you often hear in the secular press and the secular media. It's also not a dispensation from marriage. We don't annul marriages. People come to the tribunal asking for an investigation of their marriage to find out whether their marriage was contracted validly or invalidly. So what we do is a study of what happened in the past. We do a study of the marriage that they thought they were getting into and whether that agreement, that marriage contract, classifies as a valid marriage contract according to the teaching of the church. Mm-hmm. So we don't annul marriages. We study marriages to find out whether they are considered valid or invalid. And right now, there was, as you well know, there was a reform of the law, of marriage law, which happened in 2015. And ever since then, we've been getting a whole lot of new cases. So right now, we've got quite a bit of work at the tribunal.
But really, I mean, this is something you and I discussed, Father, at the time. You know, those changes that came out really didn't affect the United States. They were a lot of changes that really affected third world countries because of difficulties people were finding in being able to get access to kind of lawyers or tribunals. There's only a few elements that actually affected the United States, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. As we spoke about a year or so ago, mm-hmm. The biggest effect that those changes had on American tribunals, in an attempt to speed them up, was the elimination of the requirement for us to seek the permission of another judicial vicar to handle cases in our diocese because a respondent party did not live in our diocese. Mm-hmm. Pope Francis eliminated, you know, that concern. Mm-hmm. Essentially, if someone is petitioning in the Diocese of Camden for an annulment, with very few exceptions, as long as they have, you know, residence here in the diocese, we can pretty much handle the case.
Yeah.
It seems from what, you know, Christina and I have seen and heard in, you know, in other conferences that, you know, the American press made a big deal of what's called the shorter process. And of course, everyone jumped on the bandwagon thinking, you know, they qualified for this shorter process. And it seems from what we've heard and what we've looked at and, you know, studied ourselves, that was geared primarily for dioceses who don't have fully functional tribunals such as we have here in the United States, where indeed the bishop is the one who's going to make the decision as to whether or not he believes, you know, two people married invalidly. Mm-hmm. It also entails the cooperation of both parties. And again, in a lot of third world nations where there isn't the mobility that we have here in the United States and more developed countries, it's easier to get the cooperation of all the parties because generally, you know, they're still there.
Yeah.
You know, they're still in the village or the town, you know, where everything happened to begin with. You know, that seems to be why that shorter process was developed from what we've studied, what we've seen ourselves. You know, we have a fully functioning, you know, tribunal. You know, we can process, we can process things pretty well for the bishop. You know, there's not the need to get him involved. And quite honestly, because of the mobility of the people involved, it's more difficult to actually get the information we need in order to present a case to the bishop.
Right.
your take on it.
So one of the things that the Pope really emphasized when he reformed the law was that the teaching about marriage is not changed. So the teaching about marriage is still what we've always taught, that marriage is a union between a man and a woman for the purpose of starting a family. It's an indissoluble union, which means it's till death do you part, and it's a faithful union. So that the basics of marriage haven't changed, but the reform of the law was really about how tribunals are to process the investigation. And there were a couple little things, a couple adjustments that got made to make things more accessible and faster for people. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. The secular press, of which I'm a big fan, I work with these guys all the time in my capacity as a public relations person. The problem is, if you're a Catholic, you know, by all means, appreciate the fact that the secular media is reporting on what's going on in the Catholic Church and how it might affect Catholics in the United States and certainly in our area. However, it's also important to, in a situation like this, seek out the Catholic press, whether it's the Catholic Star Herald or any of the other national press groups, to find out, you know, okay, find the Catholic perspective on this. How is it really going to affect our lives, as opposed to how, you know, the headlines you're reading on CNN or the New York Times or
exactly.
any of your exactly. of your places, right? Or seek out your friendly neighborhood Canada lawyer to ask them as well. They'll have a pretty good idea. But even you guys, it took you guys a while to, I mean, and I don't mean you particularly, I mean Canada lawyers a while, even then, to parse what was really coming out of Rome at that time, right? I mean, there were a lot of meetings that sort of to understand what these new changes really
meant.
It
was also quite a surprise. We weren't expecting a reform of the law at that particular moment. And usually in church time is usually very long, right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden when you get a reform of the law, it hasn't been announced, you're like, oh, caught off guard, because the last one hadn't happened since 1983, and before that since 1917.
Wow.
So you only get about 1 per century.
Right, it did catch us a bit off guard.
Caught everybody off guard.
Because we were in the midst of kind of reforming our own internal processes, you know, to see what we could do to, you know, speed up the process without, in any way, you know, breaking the bounds of what needs to be done. And in the midst of that, you know, came this announcement, you know, pretty much out of nowhere.
I think even, you know, people in Rome were caught off guard.
Yeah, that you know, here were these new procedures that, you know, you've got 3 months before they become effective, which is good, you know, that the church is, you know, is capable of moving quickly when she wants to. But it did kind of, you know, you heard a lot of screeching brakes in tribunals around the country, because we'd already, you know, gotten involved in so many open cases, and now it's like, well, what do we do?
Yeah,
we've got 100 or more that are already somewhere in process that we've already opened, you know, and now this is going to entice people to, you know, start a new process. And, you know, it really was a major sea change for us in terms of how we do things. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we're just at the point now, you know, a year and a half later from the implementation, where we're just starting to feel comfortable about, you know, what we're doing with the new legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, in a sense, how to make that work. Again, initially, early on, was a lot of people, you know, saying, well, you know, I want an annulment, and I qualify for the short process. Again, because of what they heard in the secular media, mm-hmm. and having to, you know, kind of reel that in and say, well, no, not really, because you need this, you need this, you need this. So, I mean, there was still some wailing and gnashing of teeth going on, but I think, you know, people are finally getting it.
Yeah,
we're finally getting it, I think. I'll let Christina comment on that as well.
So one important thing for the faithful to keep in mind is that everyone has the right to have their marriage investigated if they ask for that investigation. It doesn't. We can never guarantee what the result will be. We can only guarantee that we will do the investigation diligently. So that's a service that's available to all the faithful. And we also are making a big effort to make our services at the tribunal more culturally accessible. So we have bilingual staff. We also have a priest that helps us to process Vietnamese cases. So we really want to make it accessible in terms of language and culture. And we've been doing this year visits to different parishes to tell parishioners about how to start a petition for an investigation of the validity or nullity of their marriage. And we also encourage people to just call the tribunal if you've got any questions.
Yeah. On an average year, about how many annulments will you process? Or at least have open?
Have open? Usually we have open more than 100. Mm. The past few years, the number has been slightly down. But in 2016, there was definitely an uptick.
Mm. Because of the belief of these.
Because of the belief of two things. What people heard, you know, in terms of the new legislation, but also because of our efforts of encouraging people to contact us, you know, yeah. to seek the process and start it. So we went from approximately 60 in 2015 to 85 in 2016. We're already approaching 40 so far this year. So again, the seminars that we've been doing have made a big difference in terms of people approaching us to at least start the process and just, you know, see where it goes.
And that's, and you know, I think people who might listen to this might say, oh, wait, they're encouraging divorces? They're encouraging people to it's actually the opposite. You're encouraging people to come back to the church in a more full way by getting the annulment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think with, we've talked about Father Klein, it can be such, because they're not only two parties. There's the, of the petitioner and the respondent, but the defender of the bond that went to, it's an interesting term, yeah. You know, but
actually,
I mean,
you
it's
know
a
what?
Right term. It's an accurate term.
Even before we get into that, maybe it might be helpful to go, let's start from beginning to end and say, how does someone, like, where does a person need to be to start considering an annulment? And then what does the process entail?
Mm-hmm. You're the procedural guru. So.
So what happens is, when a marriage is irreparably broken, so we won't even begin to look at a case unless we have a guarantee that there's no hope for getting the marriage back together. But once we see that the marriage is irreparably broken, the people have been separated for some time, then either one of them can ask the tribunal to investigate whether the marriage that they contracted was contracted validly or not, whether it was a true marriage according to the teaching of the church. So they ask us to do that investigation. And at the end of the investigation, we come up with a sentence, a decision, which says either the marriage, according to the best proofs that we have available, was contracted either validly or it was contracted invalidly. Right? So we're not, what we do is a retroactive study of something that happened in the past. We don't grant annulments. We declare whether something was valid or invalid from the beginning. That's the difference between a divorce and a declaration of nullity. A divorce puts an end to something that lived, right? But a declaration of nullity says, from the beginning, this never lived because this was not a valid marriage to begin with. Mm-hmm. So when a person comes, and anybody has the right to ask the tribunal for this investigation to be done. We can't guarantee them what the answer will be to the investigation, but they have the right to come forward and ask for an investigation, and we have the obligation to do that investigation for the faithful of the diocese. So someone will put forth a petition, and in that petition, they have to give us why they think that their marriage was contracted invalidly, if that's what they're alleging, right? And really, when there's this investigation is done by the tribunal, the two parties are not really accusing each other. It's not the husband against the wife. It's really the husband or the wife or both of them against the marriage. The marriage is considered to be a party to this investigation. And the marriage is being accused of being invalid. The marriage itself is being accused of being an invalid contract. And sometimes the husband and the wife, or can actually, we call them the petitioner and the respondent, can actually be of one mind. They could both be of the mind that it was an invalid marriage, and the marriage is still the accused party. So the marriage has its own advocate, which is called the defender of the bond. It's the lawyer for the marriage. It's like the defense attorney. And the defender of the bond has to always try to defend the marriage and try to argue that the marriage was valid, was a valid marriage. It was innocent of being invalid, mm-hmm. right? So then we will collect proofs. That's why it's an investigation. It's a judicial trial. We collect proofs, and the types of proofs that we collect are statements from the petitioner, statements from the respondent, also statements from other people who knew the couple, like, for instance, the best man, the parents, the siblings, people who would have known information that could be pertinent to the investigation. Mm. And we also sometimes collect other types of proofs, like, for instance,
psychological
investigation, or premarital agreement, a prenuptial agreement. Sometimes other types of documentary proofs, like wills and things like that, whatever is pertinent to the particular case at hand. And then once we have all the proofs collected, the statements and the different documentary proofs, the tribunal, it's called tribunal from three, right? So three judges for most cases, will study all the proofs and then render a sentence about whether the marriage meets the criteria for being considered a validly contracted marriage from the beginning. The focus of the investigation is always going to be the time that the couple contracted the marriage, the wedding. What was their state of mind, or what was the circumstances at the time of the wedding? We're not looking for everything that happened afterwards. So a lot of times people will come forth and say, well, my spouse turned out to be such a loser, and they really didn't live up to their end of the bargain. That's not grounds in and of itself for us to declare that the marriage was contracted invalidly. We're only worried about the moment of the exchange of consent at the wedding. So we always try to explain to the people that, you know, the failure to live up to your marital obligations doesn't necessarily result in a declaration of nullity. It's really whether or not the people contracted it validly from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That can be something that... people will be reticent because it can open the past if they've been married for 20 years
right.
or so. And I know Pope Francis was saying we have not just justice, but love and pastoral care. And that is something, how do you, and you have, I think, individuals to help guide this process. To help the individual, right?
I know, obviously, we want to be sensitive to people's family situations. Because you're right that sometimes the investigation is a judicial process, right? So it requires statements, it requires proofs, it requires that people explain what happened at the time of their wedding, and also what happened afterwards that sheds light on the marriage that they contracted together. We begin with the assumption that all pastoral care and mercy and sensitivity has to start with the foundation of truth. So we have to be able to shed light on what is people's true status in the church, whether the church right. considers them to be married or unmarried, according to the teaching of the church. Once we have an accurate reading about that, then we can take appropriate pastoral steps to help people live according to the status that they're in, whether the church considers them to be still married and separated, or whether the church considers that the marriage never was validly contracted to begin with. But we have to start from a foundation of what is the actual status of this person, because without that, you can't give appropriate pastoral care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, quite honestly, I mean, this is going to sound more harsh than it's intended, but it's not meant to be an easy process.
No.
Again, remember that the church is protecting its sacraments through this process. That's why we have the defender of the bond, you know, who protects the sanctity of our teaching regarding marriage. We know up front that it's going to be painful. Again, because getting a divorce can be so easy, you know, you just have to call a lawyer, you know, and it doesn't involve what's at root with why two people may have gotten married to begin with. And, you know, we fully understand that those wounds are closed. They may not necessarily be healed. The annulment process quite often does open up painful wounds, but it does so in an effort to, you know, to cauterize them.
Yeah.
To get, you know, to get what I call the junk out, you know, and it quite often involves a person having to take an interior journey that they're not used to taking. And it's painful, it's frightening, it's scary. But it's necessary because we have to get an understanding of who were these two people at the time they married. We keep a lot of tissues around. But it's that opening up, you know, that helping that individual search for the truth of who they were, who they are, you know, and you know, the person they married. You know, sometimes this is their first opportunity to really address that aspect of their own personality. You know, I take great pride in saying I think this office approaches what we do as a healing ministry, because I truly believe it gives a person an opportunity, you know, in finding their status in the church. It also gives them an opportunity to approach coming back to the church and with a whole new perspective, because of what they've been through, not only, you know, through a difficult marriage, quite often a difficult divorce, and now having to resurface all of that through, you know, a difficult annulment process. We're not unaware of that. We're very aware of that. But we're also very aware of the fact that it's a necessary journey to take to get to the truth.
Another thing that we keep in mind is that marriage is not a private sacrament, right? It's not just a private contract between two people. It's also the foundation of the domestic church, and it's the building block of the entire church. So when someone comes for an investigation of the validity or the nullity of their marriage, we're dealing with a public good, not just a private good. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have to also take into account the good of the church community that might be affected by a possibly incorrect declaration of whether the marriage was valid or invalid. So we have to protect the public good as well as the private good.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I was just going to say one other thing that I also wanted to make clear is that, you know, it's not. An annulment is not a commodity that, in a sense, can be purchased, because quite often people approach an annulment, again, the way they approached their divorce, that, well, you know, if I pay the lawyer enough money, he'll get me what I want. Hmm. It has nothing to do with the money. You know, our contention is, and you know, we have to help a person establish their status in the church, whether or not they can, you know, fully support us with the fees we request, or they can't. And we've heard the horror stories, you know, people saying, well, you know, I asked my pastor or I asked somebody and they told me it was going to cost like $25,000. You know, we've heard all kinds of figures. It's $800, and it doesn't come anywhere near covering what it costs us to actually, you know, process an annulment. And that's another thing I think that people need to be aware of, that it's not really about the money. And even if you are able to pay, you know, the $800 fees we request, as Christina has said several times, you may have entered a valid marriage. You know, so just because you paid your fees doesn't mean you're going to get what you want. Mm-hmm. You know, the fees help us conduct the investigation, and hopefully the investigation leads us to the truth of what in fact
happened
at
the wedding.
Right.
Yeah. The you know, listening to the two of you speak, it occurs to me that, you know, a lot of people, when they're entering into a marriage, you know, no one wants to think about things crashing and burning at the end. And but, you know, there's a lot of validity into understanding why it's so important to know what you're doing on the front end. You know,
those,
you know, the pre-Canas, the engagement encounters, you know, really getting to know you, making sure that, are you doing this of free will? Are you doing, do you truly understand this person? Right. Are you entering a valid marriage? You know, because I mean, I remember when we spoke a year ago, you know, one of the issues that, particularly in other cultures, are people who felt obligated to enter a marriage, and that oftentimes will invalidate a marriage if it, for lack of a better word, a shotgun wedding or something like that. So there are things that people really do need to take into account. But I, you know, I know a few people who have gone through the process. You know, oftentimes they'll think, well, yeah, but my spouse ended up being such a pain in the butt. It was a terrible husband or a terrible wife, you know, and I'm sort of stuck like this. And that has nothing to do with the annulment process, you know,
right,
which I think a lot of people misunderstand. You mentioned it earlier, but I think it's worth repeating.
Right. Because again, you know, people try to say, well, you know, we were immature when we married. Okay, well, who of us wasn't? You know, either immature when we married, or when we got ordained, or when we took on a job. What we're looking for is there a legitimate reason as to why a person was so immature that they either didn't understand or couldn't follow through on the obligations of marriage? You know, it's not just the fact, well, you know, I was 23 years old and immature. Okay, well, welcome to being human. You know, that doesn't invalidate automatically, you know, your ability to enter into a contract. Because you entered into other contracts at 23, you know, and...
One of the starting points is that it's natural to get married. And therefore, a normally functioning young adult should be able to do it. That's the basic. You don't to be able to contract a valid marriage, you don't need to be a theologian. You don't need to be an assiduously practicing Catholic. You don't even need to be Catholic to be able to contract marriage. It's the idea behind it is that a normal adult naturally is inclined to get married. So when we look for possible invalidity in the marriage, we have to start with, if it's based on a psychological ground, we want some kind of proofs that the person was not a normally functioning adult when they decide to contract marriage. There was some type of psychological anomaly. Or other reasons that marriages could be contracted invalidly sometimes are when there's lack of free will. For instance, these shotgun weddings that actually do happen a lot, especially in other countries and more traditional societies. Other types of factors which could impede a person's knowledge about marriage. For example, case of fraud, you know, if you marry and the person you really withheld a very critical piece of information that's pertinent to the marriage, those could be fraud cases. So there has to be some kind of factor which we look for proofs. It's not enough for the person just to say that this happened. There has to be some type of proof in the form of either documents or corroboration from sworn witness statements. Of some type of vice, some type of impediment going on in the knowledge, the will, or the psychological capacity of one of the contracting parties. So that's what we look for when we do an investigation.
And in the universal of the church, you know, there were societies where I believe it's young women can be 14 and young men can be 16. To marry validly and sacramentally in the Catholic Church. So there are societies, you know, out there and cultures where they marry considerably younger than Americans, and those marriages last. You know, the Church recognizes, you know, recognizes that fact. Now, even for Americans, they upped it. I believe both parties have to be 18, correct? So saying I was 23 and immature, as I said, you know, it's like, so what? What made you so immature about marriage you know, after you graduated Harvard, you know, with a degree in biophysics, you know, or whatever, why are you saying, well, I wasn't, you know, I was mature enough to get a degree, but I was too immature to marry, when we're hardwired to marry. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking for. You know, that's because in other societies, they can be teenagers.
Yeah. And that, which is also a good reminder that, you know, this canon law and the law that we follow, you know, this is, you know, universal law. I mean, right. this right. is not right. something that's specific. I mean, there's not a Catholic Church rule book for the United States. It's a Catholic Church rule book for the globe. And it's over
a billion Catholics.
So yeah.
It has to accommodate a lot.
Right.
But oftentimes we think of it through our own local eyes and, mm-hmm. you know.
Correct.
Cares about you know, right, that other continent.
That's part of the trouble.
Yeah, oftentimes, much like the media, our own perspective as well. Okay, and how big is the staff in the tribunal?
Not big enough.
Okay.
let's see. Three of us work full time. I'm the only full time priest. I have one full time judge, Dr. Laura Morrison, and one full time. clerical/transcriptionist/everything else that needs to get done. That's mm-hmm. Diane Gable. Christina works part-time in the office and does yeoman's work for me. And then I have a volunteer permanent deacon who does a lot of work with the Hispanic community for us. I don't know where I'd be without him. And we have other volunteers throughout the diocese who have been trained to help people seeking an annulment to walk with them through that process. We have lay advocates. I guess we've got about 40.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, who have been trained by us over the years to actually help a person from the very beginning of the process, and they stay with them to the very end of the process. You know, helping them, you know, answer the initial questionnaire. Mm-hmm. Searching for the documents, you know, finding ways to locate a respondent who they say, well, I don't know where he or she is. And they're very good. They're very dedicated to the volunteer ministry they do for us. Did I leave anybody out?
I think you covered everyone.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking for a while. We usually like to tie up our podcasts with a set of questions that Pete will just rattle off to you.
Okay.
I completely did not mention that to you before we started the podcast, but don't be fearful. He almost never has math involved. Almost never.
Okay,
almost never.
That's a good thing.
And just a quick question. If people need to get a hold of the tribunal office, how can they do so?
856-583-6162 or through the diocesan web page. I'm not real savvy on this stuff, but through
CamdenDiocese.org,
they'll find us there as well.
Yeah, there's a tab, I think, for tribunal
I believe
or
so.
Your office.
Yes.
So.
Actually, it's a little more specific than that. It's annulments.
Annulments.
It's under annulments.
Oh, okay.
You can't miss it. Camden Diocese no. Annulments.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I forgot about that, yes.
So thanks again, Father Klein and Dr. Christina.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
So the three questions, we need to get music, Mike. We need to somehow get something to segue into this, bumper music, but that's for later.
Okay.
First off, in this office, in the Pastoral Center, I'll just say for me, first thing I do again, I get coffee. Are you coffee or tea drinkers?
I'm a tea drinker.
Tea, really? What kind of tea?
Pretty much anything. If it's got tea in the title, I'm probably going to drink it. Yeah.
For me, it's espresso. Espresso coffee.
With all the driving she has to do around, it better be espresso.
I know, yeah.
I usually start my day with an entire pot of espresso, and then I get going.
Boy.
Wait, you drink it at home, and then you get on the road?
Exactly.
That explains a lot.
It does. She's very.
That's a lot of energy in a very small package. Christina's a very small woman.
I'm looking for the espresso IV right now. Somewhere. Do you have I know Father Klein, I was thinking about this question because I know before you, Todd, tell me you did something interesting on vacation. You took Amtrak around the country.
The past few years, a priest friend of mine, Father Michael Coffey, we've been taking Amtrak vacations across country. Last year, we went from Philadelphia through Chicago out to Los Angeles, up to Seattle, and then flew home. 2 years ago, we actually took a riverboat cruise down the Mississippi. This year, we have another vacation planned for, we're staying more east this year. So we're going from, we're going to try the Acela train from Philadelphia to Boston, catch a Red Sox game at Fenway Park, come down to New York for 2 nights and catch a Yankees game at Yankee Stadium, which I've never been in. And then a long weekend, Labor Day weekend, up in Montreal, Canada.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, love, because I've been to Montreal a couple of times. Father Mike hasn't, so...
That'll be a good trip.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
That's wonderful. I'm heading to Quebec City myself in late June, and I haven't been to Canada in a couple of years. I'm looking forward to it.
So with that question, do you have a favorite travel destination, two of you? Like any of your, Montreal or your father plan?
I've been to the Holy Land 5 times. So that would probably... I don't know if that's really a vacation or just something I do spiritually, you know, for some renewal.
I think they both count. Whether it's, you know, re-energizing your spirit or your, you know, body, I think they both count. We'll call it a vacation.
A little bit of both. That, like I said, I've been there 5 times. That's probably my favorite, one of my favorite spots. And I've just, within the past year or so, just have discovered Hawaii. I've also taken 3 Alaska cruises, so I like things a little more exotic, I guess.
Wow. Okay.
That's lovely.
I will say Hawaii is the only place I've ever visited that I didn't want to come home from. It's the first time I've ever felt like that. There was a hammock between two palm trees, and I had no intention of coming home.
I know, you better not go back. We might not see you again.
That's okay. I hear there's a diocese out there. They might hire me.
Yeah. And what about you, Doctor? Do you have a favorite town?
Cuba, of course.
Okay, well,
of course.
Yeah, can't go wrong there.
Yeah, and not just anywhere in Cuba. My home city is Santiago. It's the easternmost city, the largest eastern city. And it's very mountainous. It's also very, very poor, but it's very kind of folklorish. There's a heavy African culture.
Yeah.
This summer is going to be a lot of fun, I hope. It's not going to also be quite tiring, but I'm going to be working with a parish there, and we're having a 15-day popular mission.
Wow.
And the topic of the mission is strengthening the family. So it's going to be for kids, adolescents, and adults. Camp out.
Wow.
it's gonna be fun, I hope.
Well, I have to we have personal connection because my father was born in Santiago, Cuba.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen videos of Viñales.
Viñales.
Is that in Santiago?
No, that's far away. That's far away all the way in the west. Yeah.
Okay, he's going to kill me for getting that wrong because he showed me actually his paintings of Viñales.
Yeah, Viñales is the westernmost. One of the westernmost locations, and Santiago is the easternmost.
Just all the mango he was telling me about and the sugar. I need to come along with you one time, make that trip, because I just need to see my homeland.
Yeah.
It's kind of been a place of dreams in my head because I need to get there.
Yeah.
So that would be.
Now it's more possible. Now it's easier.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, just hop on a plane, go to Miami, and so the last question for either of you, the last book you've read.
The Code of Canon Law.
Besides
the last full book, other than something related to canon law, I mean, because I read Brother Mickey McGrath's, I don't want to call them comic books, mm-hmm. but his meditations, you know, with the drawings and everything. But the last book for pleasure that I read was a book called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, which is excellent. It's a memoir of his growing up in Eastern Kentucky and his struggles to kind of escape that culture. Excellent read.
Wow.
I highly recommend it.
Okay. Keep that in mind.
Yep.
And for me, right now I'm addicted to my Kindle app, and I love buying books on Kindle. So I've got about 4 or 5 of them open at the same time. But really, my favorite non-canonical reading is Agatha Christie.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I read when I need to just zone out.
Do you have audiobooks too for the
road? I'm starting to get into the audiobooks. Right now, okay. One of the audiobooks I've got open is The Everlasting Man, Chesterton. And I was listening to that as I exercise.
Nice to get. Yeah, I have not read Chesterton. I have a volume, one of his works, collected works. I just have not.
It's worth reading.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very much. You have now officially been our longest podcast. We've just passed the 1 hour mark, so thank you very much. I had a feeling we'd bring a couple attorneys in, and this is what ends up happening. That's all right. But that was very engaging, and certainly a topic that doesn't get brought up a lot until oftentimes at the last minute or when it's most necessary. So it's a good thing for people to be aware of and to hear about when they either need to go through it or they know somebody going through it themselves. So thank you very much for sitting with us today.
Thank you.
Pete, you have a good time. We'll actually be recording a couple of these this week, so we'll see each other a couple times.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, everybody, have a good day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you.
And you.